The phrase in the title of tonight's talk, Turbulent Times, covers a very wide terrain of troubles in our country, in the world, and in the church. In the country, we are subjected on almost an hourly basis to politics by tweet, and whether that's Ms. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or the President of the United States, or a whole cast of characters in between. In the world, we see a crack-up of the post-Cold War settlement, with new forms of aggression emerging all over the world, and in America, deeply confused about how, if at all, it should address those problems. And in the church, of course, we are in a period of unexpected doctrinal and moral instability after a period of some stability in the life and thought of the church during the pontificates of John Paul II and Benedict XVI. The book that is available for your further Lenten penance tonight, The Fragility of Order. Some of you may know that I had the idiotic idea of naming my first major book with a Latin title. It was called Tranquillitas Ordinis, Augustine's Tranquility of Order. The subtitle was The Present Failure and Future Promise of American Catholic Thought on War and Peace. Big mistake. When this one was coming out, some smarty pants said, "Oh, are we going to have now Fragilitas Ordinis?" I said, "No, I've had enough butchery of Latin titles on talk radio for a lifetime, so I think we'll pass." In any event, the book addresses all three of these sectors, if you will, or terrains of trouble. The overarching theme connecting all of this being that order, by which I don't mean stasis or simply things remaining as they are. I mean a progression into the future according to some agreed guardrails and guideposts to create the human future. That kind of order can never be taken for granted, something that I think Americans have been very late to learn in our history. But rather, that kind of order, that kind of ordering of public life is an accomplishment that has to constantly be achieved. Tonight, however, I want to focus our attention domestically and ask, what does the social doctrine of the Catholic Church have to offer by way of putting some order into thinking about the American future at a time when that future is being ever more bitterly contested across the political spectrum? I think what the social doctrine of the Church offers us, unlike perhaps any other body of thought presently available for deployment in our circumstances, is a template or framework drawn from both the ancient wisdom of the West and some deep thinking about contemporary public life, a template or framework for serious conversation and debate. The Church is not going to settle the present crisis of American democracy. The Church has got its own crisis to address at the moment, and is doing so, not least by the development of really remarkable initiatives like this Thomistic Institute. But what we can offer is what seems singularly missing right now, which is a framework, or as I say, a template for getting some order into the conversation. which is not now a conversation. It's a cacophony. It's people hollering at each other, firing cannonade, ships passing in the night, you know, shooting broadsides at each other. No real engagement. The fundamental ideas of the modern Catholic social doctrine tradition, which I want to very quickly outline tonight. This is kind of Classics Illustrated Catholic Social Doctrine. Who remembers Classics Illustrated? Come on, raise your hand. You know you cheated too. For those of you who are too young to have remembered the apotheosis of American comic books, Classics Illustrated were comic books that took classics of world literature and boiled them down into a 40-page comic book. It was Cliff's Notes before there was Cliff's Notes, okay? So this is going to be the Classics Illustrated version of Catholic social doctrine. That social doctrine, in its main points, has been articulated by three popes. Leo XIII, who was pope from 1878 to 1903, Pope Pius XI, who was Bishop of Rome from 1922 until 1939, and Pope St. John Paul II, who, of course, was pope from 1978 until 2005. The first two pieces of the foundation of Catholic social doctrine were put in place by Leo XIII, in the late 19th century, the first two foundational principles of the social doctrine. We find these not only in Leo's famous social encyclical Rerum Novarum, which, as many of you know, began the whole tradition of the papal social encyclicals. We find them in his other writings on the nature of the state, the nature of justice, the nature of law, the nature of freedom, etc. The first of those principles is typically referred to as personalism, the personalist principle, or what in a more contemporary Anglo-Saxon vocabulary we might call the human rights principle. And according to the personalist principle at the foundation of Catholic social doctrine, all right thinking about society and politics begins with the inalienable dignity and value of the human person, which is to say, along the via negativa, it does not begin with the state or the party or the tribe or the racial group or the gender group. All right thinking about society and politics begins with the inalienable dignity and value of the human person, which means that society and the state exist to serve the flourishing of human beings, of those persons who are persons by reason of their capacity for right choosing as creatures of intellect and free will. That also means that what we have come to call in a modern political vocabulary, human rights are built in to the human person. They're not benefices conferred by the state. You do not enjoy the first of civil rights, religious freedom, because benign government has allowed you to claim that right. You enjoy that right by virtue of who you are, and the state is obligated to acknowledge that and indeed protect it. But in a classic example of what is often called the Catholic both and, Catholicism is both and, less a matter of either or, Leo XIII immediately complemented that personalist principle with what is technically called the principle of the common good, or what we might call in a contemporary vocabulary the communitarian principle. So the human rights principle is complemented by the communitarian principle. Men and women grow into the fullness of their humanity through relationships. As Jacques Maritain would put it, a person is an open whole, W-H-O-L-E, who finds fulfillment not in isolation, but in community. Therefore, I, the individual person, bearer of those inalienable rights, should exercise my rights in such a way that my freedom contributes to the general welfare of society, not simply to my self-aggrandizement. So, the personalist principle and the principle of the common good are the two most fundamental building blocks at the foundation of Catholic social doctrine. And they remain really the two essential pieces of the foundation until 1931. And then in 1931, in order to commemorate the 40th anniversary of Rerum Novarum in 1891, Pope Pius XI issues the encyclical Quadragesimo Anno for the 40th year, the anniversary encyclical for Rerum Novarum, and he cements a third foundational principle into this Catholic social doctrine, which in the vocabulary of theology we call the principle of subsidiarity, or what we might call in a more familiar vocabulary the free associational principle, or the principle of civil society. Remember where we are here, 1931. So the long shadow of the totalitarian project is extending itself across Europe. First in the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, then Mussolini, Hitler is 2 years away, but is manifestly on the scene. And what is the common thread among those projects? It's what Mussolini described as totalitarianism when he said, totalitarianism means nothing outside the state, everything within the state, everything for the state. Now, over against that, Pius XI posed this principle of subsidiarity, according to which, he wrote in Quadragesimo Anno, decision-making in society should be left at the lowest possible level, commensurate with the common good. You don't ask the national government to run the fire department. You don't ask the local fire department to take care of national defense. American federalism, although I'm quite sure James Madison never heard the word subsidiarity, is an expression of this principle. National government does some stuff, state governments do other stuff, local governments do still other stuff, and they often cooperate. You know, the states are responsible for maintaining the interstate highway system, but the federal government collects the taxes to do that. It's a complex, multi-tiered, pluralistic vision of society. What it is not, to go back to the 2012 election, is the famous Julia cartoon ad that the Obama campaign ran during that year. You remember there's this cartoon character, this young woman who, you know, makes her way through life, and the only actors in her life are herself and the state. They're the only two. Pius XI said, A, that's simply not the way the world works. You know, there are families, there are neighborhoods, there are all sorts of free associations of people, business, trade unions, cultural and social groups, whatever. And B, if the only two actors in a 20th century society are the individual and the state, that is a prescription for disaster of a particularly grim authoritarian form. This subsidiarity principle inoculated Catholic social doctrine from the totalitarian temptation, which is a perennial one. I wrote about this recently in my weekly column. We may have thought totalitarianism was over, or that impulse to reduce everything to the individual and the state was over with the end of the Cold War. It's simply not the case. That is built into political modernity because it provides an easy answer to the confusions, consternations, instabilities of modernity. Let's just have somebody settle everything and we'll all live happily ever after. So there is an anti-totalitarian and indeed anti-statist principle, perhaps better to use that today, built into the social doctrine from 1931 on. Then, in the pontificate of John Paul II, which I'll go into in a bit more detail in just a moment, a fourth foundational principle is cemented into the foundation, and that is what we can call the principle of solidarity or the principle of civic friendship. The free and virtuous society of the future, John Paul II taught, depends on a deeper level of human relationships than mere contracts. If all that the people of a free society in the late 20th and 21st century know about each other, and in a sense feel about each other, is that they can sue each other. Everybody's a legal actor, and the nature of the relationship is that when things get excessively chippy, we can take each other to law. That is an insufficient human texture to make freedom work in the 20th and 21st centuries. Rather, what is required, John Paul II would say, is a kind of civic or associational instinct and sense of obligation that in the American context, Alexis de Tocqueville discerned in the early 19th century in our country and wrote about so movingly in Democracy in America, whether it was barn raisings or whatever, this associational instinct. I am not a monad. I am an integral part of a community in which there are mutual obligations. Tocqueville saw very much built into the American experience. Perhaps the most powerful expression of this principle of subsidiarity was visible 30 years ago, which is not that long ago. In 1989 and what led up to 1989 in Central and Eastern Europe, when that part of the world auto-liberated itself from the Soviet Empire, how? By a critical mass of people with aroused consciences, recognizing that they had obligations to their neighbor beyond what the communist state told them they were, and that out of that mutual sense of obligation could be developed tools of resistance that the communist authorities could not match. The Maidan Revolution of Dignity in Ukraine in the winter of 2013-2014, I would suggest, was another example of this solidarity principle at work. And then, of course, here in the extended metro New York area, as well as in the swamp and where I live, we saw this on 9/11, where people who had absolutely no idea whom they were risking their lives for, nonetheless put themselves in harm's way out of a sense of solidarity and obligation. And that sense of mutual purpose, John Paul II would write on many occasions, is the fourth, that solidarity principle is the fourth great principle of the social doctrine of the church. So, personalism, the common good, subsidiarity, solidarity, the human rights principle, communitarian principle, the principle of civil society, and the principles of civic friendship. On that foundation, John Paul II laid an edifice over his 26 years of poping that I think helps fill out this template that might be of some use in putting order into our American domestic debate over the American future. It might have some opportunity, some chance of transforming cacophony into conversation. These points are found first, foremost, and in their most developed way in the 1991 encyclical Centesimus Annus, written for the 100th anniversary of Rerum Novarum, as the very title, Centesimus Annus, the 100th year, suggests. There are six crucial points here, which I continue to find intriguing. I've been talking about this for almost 30 years now, and I continue to find intriguing because they come out of the reflection of a man who is certainly building on the thought of his predecessors, Leo XIII and Pius XI. But here's a man who never lived in a mature democracy in his life, never lived in a serious market economy in his life, and nonetheless had these penetrating insights into both. Let's look at six of them. The first, the free and virtuous society of the future, John Paul II said, and remember, this is 2 years after the collapse of the wall, so we're looking at a post-Cold War world here. The free and virtuous society of the future is composed of three interlocking parts. How many of you went to college on the East Coast 40-some years ago and remember Ballantine beer? Right. Cheap beer, right? Remember the three rings of the Ballantine can? Okay, that's what we're talking about. Three interlocking component parts of the free and virtuous society. A democratic political community, meaning popular participation in government and all the things that we associate with that. A free economy, or a market-centered, if regulated, economy, and a vibrant public moral culture. And the third is the key to all the rest. The cultural sector is the key to the proper functioning of the democratic political community and the free economy. Why? Because free politics and free economics let loose tremendous human energies. And therefore, a society in which those energies have been let loose needs a vibrant public moral culture to discipline and direct those energies so that they result in the flourishing of individual human beings, the common good, solidarity, and ultimately beatitude. So it's not sufficient to simply talk about democracy or the market. It's democracy, free economy, vibrant public moral culture. Second point. Democracy and the market, John Paul II insisted, are not machines that can run by themselves. I remember at the time of the bicentennial of the Constitution, 1987, a constitutional scholar whose name escapes me wrote a book about the framing of the Constitution that was actually called A Machine That Could Run by Itself. I mean, this was his idea of what Madison in particular had in mind. This is a very weird reading of Madison. I think it's a false reading of both Madison and of the Democratic Project. Democracy and the market are not machines that can run by themselves. It requires a certain kind of people possessed of a certain set of virtues. If these impressive machines are not to self-destruct, it's not simply a matter of designing your constitution, getting your powers and checks and balances defined, having an articulated Bill of Rights and all that sort of stuff. Nor is it, as the libertarians would urge us to imagine, nor is it sufficient for a properly functioning economy to just, you know, get the machinery set up and then let everybody, get everybody else out, particularly the state, out of the way, turn the ignition key on, and things function. We should have learned in 2007, 2008. That doesn't work out too well. It requires a certain kind of people, a critical mass of people, possessed of a certain set of virtues, if those machines are not going to self-destruct. And here I think, although, frankly, in our many conversations over a period of a dozen years, we never actually talked about this, John Paul II and I think the shadow in the back of his mind here was the Weimar Republic, was interwar Germany, which, as you know, many of you know, I'm sure, had a beautifully designed constitution, one of whose authors was the great sociologist Max Weber. You know, and all the pieces looked pretty good. And yet, because the cultural foundation was too shallow, when the crunch came in the form of the Great Depression, the machinery, the beautifully balanced designed machinery of the Weimar Republic ended up producing the Third Reich. John Paul II was very, I mean, he knew the Third Reich literally in his bones, since he had seen his country invaded and occupied by it. But he never forgot that the Third Reich originally came to power through a democratic process. Now, Hitler immediately shut down the democratic process, that's all true, with the enabling law of 1933. But he was put in power by a well-designed machine for which the cultural foundation was simply inadequate. So of those three component parts, John Paul II would say it's a task of the culture to form those habits of heart and mind that make the proper functioning of democracy and the market possible. And it's the task of the church to help form that culture by forming the individuals who create the culture. So the church is not in the solutions business. The church offers a vision of the human person and the free and virtuous society that can shape a culture capable of disciplining the energies of freedom, both politically and economically, so that, as I said a moment ago, the result is the flourishing of individuals, the advance of the common good, a sense of solidarity, ultimately beatitude. At the center of that culture formation project, and here we come to the third point, is a richer, nobler concept of freedom than that which dominates in our public life today. In Centesimus Annus, John Paul II taught that freedom must be tethered to moral truth if freedom is not to be self-cannibalizing. If freedom is reduced, as it so often is today, to a free-floating faculty of choice that can attach itself to anything, this freedom of indifference will eventually erode the machinery of democracy. Why? Because if freedom is simply a question of my truth contesting with your truth, and both of us arrive at that truth simply as a matter of will, we choose, this is what I, you know, this is my choice. What happens when your truth and my truth conflict and neither one of us recognizes something called the truth by which we can settle the argument? Well, Friedrich Nietzsche, call your office. Either you will impose your power on me, or I will impose my power on you. When that translates out to the social level, we get what Benedict XVI warned about so many times, the dictatorship of relativism, the use of coercive state power in order to enforce on all or impose on all of society a relativistic morality. So rather than this freedom of indifference, freedom as mere willfulness, the Catholic Church proposes freedom for excellence, freedom as a habit, freedom as the virtue of choosing what we can know to be good and rational, and doing that as a matter of habit, doing it time and time and time again. I often take a note from a great Dominican theologian of the 20th century, Father Servet Pinkers, who coined these phrases, freedom of indifference and freedom for excellence. And he said it's like, the way to understand this is think of playing a musical instrument. Anybody can bang on a piano. I choose to bang on the piano. That is not music. If you want to actually make music, if you want to exercise your freedom so that you make music, you have to learn the skills acquired by often dull exercises that train your fingers to do what you want them to do. How many of you studied piano as a child? Do you have a book called Scales, Chords, and Arpeggios? Remember that? First book I ever wanted to burn in my life. Dreadful stuff, but absolutely necessary to learning how to translate banging into music. So the other example Pinkers uses is perhaps even better, is learning a language. Second language, third language, whatever. Even your first language. Everybody knows that the best way to learn a language is to speak it and hear it and just keep trying. But at some point, you have to learn the rules of grammar and you have to learn vocabulary. And those are, vocabulary is a set of rules too. I mean, this means this and not something else. But when you do that, you can actually communicate. Just as when you do those horrible scales, chords, and arpeggios, you can eventually make music. So freedom for excellence, not freedom for indifference. A mature freedom. I have 4 2/3 grandchildren. The fifth is arriving in June, hence the 4 2/3, at least as the world measures these things. Number three, Lucy, is a beautiful 2-year-old bundle of total willfulness. She manifests the freedom of indifference 24/7. But it's not just Lucy, huh? I mean, every 2-year-old ever born, including every one of us, boys and girls, was a little natural-born tyrant, right? So what transforms those tyrants into the kind of people who can make freedom work for their own benefit and for the common good? That brings us to the fourth idea here, and that is the crucial importance of the voluntary association in society. It's not just the individual in the state. It's everything from the natural association of the family to voluntarily entered associations like businesses, unions, social, political, and cultural groups. All of these, John Paul II would say, are essential to the free and virtuous society. This is that mediating layer of society that we tend more and more to call civil society today. And those civil society institutions, beginning with the family, John Paul II would say, are the first schools of freedom. And the first freedom properly understood. Schools where all the tyrants get turned into small d Democrats. And the first of those is the family. The first of those is the family. So, the free and virtuous society, three component parts. The culture as the lubricant, if you will, the essential lubricant of both democracy and the market. The richer, nobler, more frankly mature concept of freedom, freedom for excellence, and the development of that virtue of freedom through the experience of voluntary associations. Those are the four ideas that John Paul II erects on top of that foundation of the four fundamental principles before he turns to the free economy. And let me just say a couple of things about that. Centesimus Annus, at the end of 100 years of Catholic social doctrine, beginning with Rerum Novarum, has many interesting characteristics, but one of them is that it breaks with a pattern of thought that really dominated Catholic social doctrine up through Pope Paul VI. And that was the notion that wealth is stuff. Wealth is either land or resources or the stuff you make out of land and resources. But wealth is basically stuff. And particularly if we think in terms of land as stuff, as we all know, and as the real estate agents keep telling us, God is not making real estate anymore, right? There's a finite amount of stuff. Well, if there's a finite amount of stuff, then the primary moral question becomes, how do you equitably divide up the stuff? Because there's only so much of it, and therefore the primary question of justice is how does everyone get an equitable piece of that? John Paul II, who again, let's say, remind ourselves, never lived in a market economy, never wrote a check in his life, never had a bank account, somehow understood that in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, wealth was no longer just stuff. In fact, wealth wasn't even primarily stuff. Wealth was a matter of ideas, skills, entrepreneurial instincts applied to stuff so that wealth actually grew. Well, it's not a fixed pot. Wealth can grow. The wealth of nations, to borrow a phrase from Adam Smith, is no longer stuff in the ground or the ground itself. Wealth resides in the human mind, in human creativity. And if that's what wealth is, then the moral question shifts from distribution to inclusion. If it's a growing pie, then the question of justice becomes, how do we facilitate everyone acquiring the skills and habits that allows them to get into the pie-growing business, to become part of the networks of production and exchange that grow wealth? That's the fifth point. The sixth point borrows from the fifth and asks us to think about poverty in a new way. Poverty, John Paul II understood in the late 20th early 21st centuries. Excuse me, would certainly involve a lack of basics in certain parts of the world. But in most of the world, it would primarily be a problem of exclusion. People were excluded from or did not have the skills and personal habits to engage in those networks of production and exchange where wealth was created and distributed. So we should think of the poor, he urged us, not as an abstract problem to be solved, primarily with a welfare benefit, but as people with potential. People with potential to be unleashed. Therefore, he was very critical of social welfare systems that led to welfare dependency, and very affirming of welfare systems and educational programs aimed at bringing the poor into the circle of productivity and exchange. John Paul II would have loved something like the Cristo Rey schools that have been created by the church, and particularly the Jesuits, if the Dominicans will forgive me, all over the United States. Elementary and secondary schools, poor kids have to be below, family has to be below the poverty line for the kid to get in. But the kid not only goes to school, the kid works to help pay their own tuition. So there's a partnership between the school and local businesses to make all of this work. These young people develop the habits of heart and mind necessary to function in this kind of a society. To listen to these young people who have come through the Cristo Rey system talk about what it did for them is to see the social doctrine of the church at work and to be very proud to be a Catholic, because we're the only people doing it. Charter schools are trying it and whatnot, but I mean, we have a real track record here in the empowerment of the poor through Catholic education. So those are two ideas on the free economy side of things from John Paul II. A couple of other brief notes about his social thought, although these are not really social doctrine issues as such. In the 1993 encyclical on the renewal of Catholic moral theology, Veritatis Splendor, John Paul II asked an interesting question that I do wish someone would finally write a dissertation about, because he made an interesting proposal for answering the question. He observes the quality of persons is a fundamental principle of democratic society, right? We all know that. But how do we justify that? What's the warrant for that? Every day we see some people are smarter than other people, some people are prettier than other people, some people are more athletic than other people. Some people are Zion Williamson, some people are Father Kalish. It's a big difference here, you know. Some people have language skills, other people don't. The fact presented to us 24/7 is human inequality. So how do we warrant equality? His very, I think, creative suggestion was that the most secure foundation to assert the equality of everyone is the equal obligation of everyone before the principles of the moral law, especially the obligation to avoid intrinsically evil acts, things that are simply wrong in and of themselves, and no combination of intentions and consequences can possibly make right. Rape would be, a pretty obvious example. But, theft, the destruction of someone's character by lying, there's a whole list of these things we could go through. we're all obligated to honor the thou shalt nots about intrinsically evil acts. That's a very interesting idea if you're creating a theory of democracy. Now, the problem with creating that today is that a great number of not only intellectuals, but of our fellow citizens, believe there are no such things as moral truths embedded in us and in the world that we can know by reason. There's only your truth and my truth and all that kind of stuff. But still, the idea remains, and it's worth somebody, it's very much worth somebody developing as part of the reconstruction of a democracy that is something more than a simply choice on steroids. The other interesting little idea that John Paul II laid on top of this edifice came in the 1995 encyclical Evangelii Vitae, the Gospel of Life, which was not a social encyclical like Centesimus Annus, but did have some interesting and important things to say about the free and virtuous society. For example, that democracies risk self-destruction if what we can know to be moral wrongs, namely the willful taking of innocent human life, for example, are legally defended as rights. Now, this is obviously a huge issue in our own country today, and while it has been focused for 46 years now on the beginning of the life spectrum, it's now increasingly focused on the end, on the euthanasia debate. And there is a serious threat to the democratic future, John Paul II would say, I would agree, if these things that we can know, and not simply by revelation, although that helps, but by an exercise of reason, to be morally wrong are legally defended as rights. Which then, if we say that, lays upon us the obligation to help people who find themselves in very difficult situations. This is why the essential complement to right to life advocacy is crisis pregnancy centers. This is why the essential complement to the euthanasia juggernaut is hospice care and the increasing availability of palliative and life care, et cetera, et cetera. Above all, in Evangelium Vitae, John Paul II said that to reduce human beings to useful or useless objects deeply damages the cause of freedom. When I was writing Witness to Hope, or preparing Witness to Hope, I found it absolutely fascinating that in 1957-58, in that academic year, Wojtyła's graduate seminar at the University of Lublin in Poland. These were his really smart graduate philosophy students. Were reading Jeremy Bentham, the father of utilitarianism. Now, here's a guy who is battling communism 24/7, and they're not reading Marx to try to figure out what the answer to that is. They're reading Bentham. It's like he intuited this thing is going to be over sooner rather than later, but the next threat to freedom lived for beatitude, in solidarity, for the common good, is utilitarianism. And we better be thinking through what the response is to that. And of course, that was another prescient insight, because we are awash in utilitarian thinking today, and it is deeply, as he suspected, corroding the foundations of our society. If I were to sum up all of this in a phrase or a trope, I suppose one might call it, these fundaments of the Catholic social doctrine, of the social doctrine of the Church, urge developed democracies like our own to take seriously human ecology. Ecology is not just a matter of recycling and all the stuff we associate with environmental activism. There is a human ecology without which freedom does not work. Tomorrow morning, or early tomorrow afternoon, I'm going to be up at Tufts at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy talking with some students about Russia, Ukraine, Orthodoxy, Catholicism, and how all of that has something to do with each other. And one of the points I'm going to make is that for all of its spiritual riches, and they are significant, Russian Orthodoxy has never, at least in the modern period and arguably before that, never fostered the creation of a human ecology that would make the exercise of freedom work politically or economically. It just hasn't done. And that's one of the reasons why, after the brief Yeltsin period of kind of Wild West democracy in post-Soviet Russia, Russia reverted to a new form of authoritarianism. This time it's authoritarian kleptocracy rather than communism. The human ecology just wasn't there. This is what my friends in Ukraine are struggling with today. 75 years of damage done to the human ecology by the communist system have to be quickly repaired in order to try to make a go of this democracy for whom 100 people sacrificed their lives in Kiev 4.5 years ago, and 10,000 now have sacrificed their lives in the Donbass region of eastern Ukraine since the Russian invasion. Human ecology is critical. And if, all of which is to say that in the social doctrine of the church, politics and economics are downstream from culture. And if, to take the political example, we are unhappy with the state of our political culture right now, the state of our politics, we need to look downstream, we need to look upstream to what's going on in the culture that has, in a sense, cashed out in the visible effects that we now see in our public lives. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Weigel. So as Mr. Weigel mentioned, we do have a few minutes left for questions, and he'll take his own questions.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you for your talk. This idea of a free and virtuous society, to me that in a way implies that the fall never happened. In other words, it implies that we can all be truly virtuous and truly free and just ignore the fact that we're born into sin, that we're sinners, and that the fall never happened. But I don't understand how those two ideas can be seen together in agreement. They seem to be incompatible.
I don't see how you draw that conclusion from what I said, so we've got a problem here. I mean, it's manifestly clear that if you say a society needs a critical mass of virtuous people, one of the reasons for that is if you don't have that, the effects of the fall will be manifest all over society. So to talk about the necessity of public virtue is to concede the point, which any rational person would do, that original sin has deeply wounded the human condition. Therefore, to live freedom well requires both the virtue of individuals and a public moral culture that sustains individuals in their pursuit of virtue. Are we ever going to have a completely free and completely virtuous society? Yes, it's called the Wedding Feast of the Lamb, and you can read about it in the 22nd chapter of Revelation. That's not going to happen here, and that's the obvious premise of all of this. Yes, sir.
Thanks for coming to talk with us tonight. I appreciate that you incorporated the ecological
framework by the end. And I want to inquire how thoroughgoing you consider the topology of the system here. You mentioned that putting all these principles together and principles together, we can see that politics and economics are downstream from culture. It's kind of use an ecological metaphor there. I don't know if this is actually, you know, if you're going to do ecological thinking, you've got to think materially. And if we ask the question, do politics and economics influence culture? I feel like all of us would have to say yes. I mean, Crystal Ray had to be financed. And so I kind of wonder whether it's fair to... I mean, I would never dispute that culture has to be a site of intervention, and I think that even plenty of theorists of the left wouldn't say that everything only comes down to individual and the state. They would be talking about human relationships left and right. So I guess I wonder whether you've portrayed fairly the other side in the conversation. It's very noble that you wish to get past the bombardment back and forth, you know, and find a way to have the conversation in the middle there. But are we in good faith enough in our representation of the alternative to attribute lots of cultural thinking and deep cultural thinking on their part, and asking whether or not politics and economics are often just as well upstream from culture?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And clearly the production of certain kinds of stuff, pornography, for example, is a culture-rotting thing. So there's clearly influence in that direction. But I would say at the center of, you talk about, you know, the left today, however much there is an appeal to neighborhoods and all the rest of it, the central idea of the postmodern left is the autonomous self-constituting self. And that is what the left will die, today's left, which is not the same as the left of the mid to late, early to late 20th century. That's what they will die in the last ditch for. That's what you see in the refusal to even describe what happens in an abortion accurately. That's what you see in the euthanasia debate. That's what you see in the deconstruction of marriage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's the absolute commitment to the autonomy of individual choice. Now, that has a cultural background. I mean, that comes from somewhere. That just didn't happen, and we could spend days and weeks here analyzing that. But I think that's not an unfair description. And I think you see it manifest in our politics today. You cannot have a serious debate about even late-term abortions as long as this choice Trump card gets taken out and the autonomy of the individual woman it becomes... The overriding, indeed, the necessarily trumping factor in the argument. And that's just wrong. And I think that's a very significant part of the problem today. I don't doubt that people who hold that view are feeling threatened right now. Because the results of this... have built up a resistance that I frankly find distasteful in many of its expressions. But you cannot run a democratic society on the basis of radical individual autonomy. It just isn't going to work. And as long as that remains the linchpin of that project, we're going to have real trouble, it seems to me. Yeah, one more here.
So, both in sort of your initial discussion of personalism, which you let off tonight, and then also, in your discussion of sort of modern wealth, that, we should sort of let people, their genius sort of, we should develop the genius to, create all sorts of new wealth in our economy, like Dr. Kimball Popper and pornography, as you said, that's sort of what we're making today.
Is that all we're making?
It's quite good.
Is it?
I think I've been sort of confused a bit. There wasn't much of a discussion of ends, of human flourishing and that sort of thing. But ultimately, as Catholics, we believe that all human beings in the world will only find their true happiness, their true purpose,
right,
in the Catholic Church, the embrace of Jesus Christ. How can we as societies, we're all sort of part of, the state is, we're democratic, the state is ultimately, coming together and working together for the common good. How can we, as a society, not want to, put Christ as a king? Why should we be, why should not, in the words of Charles Carlton, why shouldn't the common good be primary over individual? Why shouldn't we be thinking more about our duties? Certainly, today, the human dignity and human rights and personal benefit. Some pro-homosexual activists were talking to Carmel Carleone and trying to use the church's love of human dignity and personal dignity as, trying to say that the church supports human sodomy.
And the question is,
why it seems to me that personalism, while it's obviously important, it seems that we've lost the thread of it. And that perhaps we should be focusing more on what are our duties.
I don't doubt that. I think, as I said, Leo immediately complemented the personalist principle with the common good principle. So these go together from the beginning. You are one of many people of your age who has obviously read Quas Primas, Pius XI's encyclical. I do not understand how Donald Trump declaring Jesus Christ the King of America advances the evangelical mission of the church. I think it impedes the evangelical mission of the church, as I believe any state intervention in theological matters is in almost always an impediment to the evangelical mission of the church. The modern state is really a matter, it's a means thing. The culture has to provide the ends, and the church has to inform that culture. But I really do not want the United States government or the government of the People's Republic of Maryland, where I live, pronouncing on theological questions, because they always get them wrong. This is just not a good idea. And I think what I sense in that is that yearning for an integral pulling together of everything, deep dissatisfaction with the present circumstance. Speaking as somebody who used to be the youngest guy in the room all the time and is now semi-cranky middle-aged guy, it's never going to happen. It's not there. It wasn't there in Louis IX. Despite recent books to that effect, it's not part of, to go back to where we were a moment ago, post-lapsarian human condition. So we have to figure out how to make genuine pluralism, meaning orderly conversation about common good based on agreed moral principles work again. All of that has fallen down. And you are undoubtedly right that the corruption of personalism into radical individualism, into this autonomy project, is a large part of it. So, that's it. Thank you.